This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. We're so glad to have you with us on this day when we remember, honor, and reflect on the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. A writer, philosopher, organizer, and strategist, King played many roles in the mid-century movement for civil rights. But perhaps most enduringly, King has come to represent the literal voice of the movement.
Now, my friends, I return home more determined than ever before to give my life to the struggle to remove racial injustice from every area of our nation's life.
Drawing from a great well of Black oratorical tradition, his deep baritone, deliberate pacing, tonal quality, and dynamic shifts are hallmarks of a voice that remains instantly recognizable.
More determined than ever before to give my life.
A voice so singularly powerful, it's easy to mistake it as encompassing the totality of what the civil rights movement sounded like.
What we miss is that there was this whole sonic experience and phonic substance to the civil rights movement that really comes from the people in the crowd who were doing the work, part of the movement in their own home spaces, their small rural communities, their urban spaces. And to them, the movement sounded different.
This is Claire B. Crawford. She's a doctoral candidate at the University of Southern California.
The movement sounded much, in some capacities, like church. And then little changes to it that we come to know as like freedom songs. And it sounded like the speeches that were given by folks around them. And it sounded like what was happening between them on those packed pews at mass meetings and workshops. And so if we only hear Dr. King's voice, we forget that there was millions of other folks really sounding. You know, he was the drum major, but who was really providing the tune to it?
I want you to walk me through the band a bit. If he's the drum major, I want you to walk me through some of the instruments.
So we have some really iconic voices that come out of the Albany movement.
Now, the Albany movement of 1961 and 62 was initiated by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. And for decades, historians have regarded the Albany movement as though it were a failure, because it lacked both the spectacular violence and the watershed legislative gains of places like Montgomery, Birmingham, or Selma. But Claire Crawford reminded us Albany is no failure, because it was here that the SNCC Freedom Singers were born. Ruth Mae Harris is one of the original SNCC Freedom Singers, and she spoke with Georgia Public Broadcasting.
The slaves were singing like, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on Jesus. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on Jesus. And we would just change the word Jesus to freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
And some of the lead voices that I think of immediately are Bernice Johnson Reagan of Sweet Honey and the Rock. And so we might know like what she sounds like now, but definitely reading and hearing her talk about over and over again that the voice, the movement gave her her voice, the voice that we know her to have today. And so for her, it's about like her living changed a song.
Over my head, I see freedom in the air.
And so when we hear the song Freedom in the Air, she really writes about it over and over again, how coming out of jail, you would hear she was walking, marching, going back to a mass meeting after leaving the city jail, and she started to sing. And she changed the words to the song without even knowing. And so then she sung out Freedom in the Air.
I see freedom in the air. There must be over.
And so there's this like really loud, powerful voice that really came out because of this fight for freedom. And so if we were to just like go to a pew for a second, oftentimes we always hear the speeches from the people who were in the pulpit, but it was really only exciting for them to give a speech because of who was sitting in the pew. And so women mostly lined the pews during the movement. This is definitely evidently true for Montgomery bus boycott and how the boycott really carried on because of the women. Bernice Johnson Reagan has this beautiful quote that singing is an organizing experience.
Singing is an organizing experience. It gathers and directs us individually and collectively.
Walk with me, not Lord. Walk with me.
That's what we need.
Meet
Jesus.
While I'm on.
Listen to Fannie Lou Hamer. I mean, really listen. This is the entreaty of the 2021 musical by a Seattle playwright named Cheryl West. Fannie, the music and life of Fannie Lou Hamer, reveals how this co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party used both her singing and speaking voice as organizing tools, drawing on melodic and harmonic traditions anchored in Black Southern life.
Is this America? The land of the free and the home of the brave. Where we have to speak.
I want Jesus.
With our telephones off of the hook, because our lives be threatened daily.
Make a way for me.
Because we want to live as decent human beings in America.
Make a way for me. Now, make a way for me.
Things are on purpose. These sort of like sonic gestures that I pay attention to, hums, moaning, and hollering, have meaning that reach beyond the depth of just like speaking words.
As you point out, if we're thinking about Dr. King making the call, and then I hear you saying hums, moaning, and hollering, and we'll talk about murmurs as well, they're all part of the response. How is it that the response has power relative to the call? What does somebody sitting or crew of people sitting in the pews, how do they direct the drum major? How do they make the sermon or the organizing speech move by their responses?
So we have, like you said, the call and response, which a lot of folks refer to as a lingering kind of like Africanism coming across from the Atlantic during enslavement and really being carried on and oftentimes seen in these Black church spaces. Let's say you're giving a speech or you're speaking, someone's speaking from the pulpit and you can hear the word well, right? Coming out from someone.
Well.
Yeah. So there's that well, right? Like there's that well in agreement. And then you could have the word well, where it's kind of just you said something, maybe speaking to the injustices that we understand and really move on. Or you can have that like kind of like low well, where you're just kind of like, well, where, you know, it's like really, but it's this like conversation that's really happening between someone who is speaking and the audience that they're speaking to. And so the call and response was so much of a necessary part where you knew what you were saying meant something to the folks around you because they continued to respond with you, right? And you didn't lose them, and they understood and they related to it. And so you have like the yes, the amens, the wells, the kind of like, And I mean, you can hear these being necessary, even if we take Dr. King's first speech in Montgomery to his last speech, how like important, and even how he made space, right, for this response to really be a part of the way that he's actually like talking to folks and communicating. Right? He's not just giving a speech for the sake of speaking. He's trying to create a feeling. And so that call and response reminds you that like justice is an experience of love, justice is an experience of connection. And so the way that we really change and create it is you can hear it. You can hear justice really being taking shape on this pew, taking shape in the amens, taking shape in the hollers, taking shape even like, you know, if we really want to get into it, you know, you're packed on this pew. So if somebody just does like a deep, you can feel that in your body, on your arms, and then the pew might shake if it's a wooden pew, right? And so you know folks are having this experience that is both basically a combination of what you might call like this secular, political, Christian Judeo experience in one space that's familiar for y'all. And I always think it's interesting when we say, like, go back to the fact that they use churches, because we know that churches weren't the biggest spaces, but sometimes they were the most comfortable, familiar ways to like change a setting into something deeper, right? It's already a meaning of deep meaning space. And so now you're just like, now we're going to add justice into the mix and really get people to catch on to that. So I would say that's how I would describe kind of like what's happening for folks and why that call and response is so necessary and important.
Oh, tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere. Oh, tell it on the mountain, let my people go.
Claire, stick with me. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to make sure we don't just stay in a liberation story about the 1950s and 60s. I want you to talk to me about what liberation sounds like right now today. Take a quick break right here.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the furor on college campuses over the war in Gaza.
Students have tried to have dialogue over and negotiate differences in how they see the world, even as they respond to tragedies and crimes overseas.
Students and faculty from Harvard University on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Back and continuing my conversation about the sonic landscape of Black liberation with doctoral candidate at the University of Southern California, Claire Crawford. You've walked us through a lot of what power sounds like in the moment that is the mid-century civil rights movement. But that is not the end of a movement for Black liberation, right? Skip over a whole lot of history and a whole lot of time and just come up with me to the contemporary moment and tell me, what exactly is trap?
All right, so trap music, we can think of it as a subgenre of Southern hip hop that really begins in the late 90s. It has very key similarities to that of Southern hip hop. So we have the huge bass, the 808s, that kind of like beating on the sound, the rapid speed is kind of what it brings. And so trap music sonically kind of gives you that particular experience of what you hear.
People speaking for the people, I'm proud of them. Stick together, we can get it up out of them. I can't lie like I don't rap about killing and dope, but I'm telling my youngers to vote. I deal with ideas, I didn't have no choice and no hope. I was forced to just jump in and go. But it's time for a change, got time to be serious, no time for no games. Ain't taking no more, let us go from them chains. God bless they soul, every one of them names.
Now, what the voices sound like over those beats sometimes are a little different than maybe like what we might characteristically call Southern hip hop. If we were to look at a group like Outkast, right? So we might look at them a little bit differently. But what we really hear in trap music is kind of in the early 2000s, maybe 2010s. This is a little bit of a change. And they're really pulling in kind of like this combination of true like gangster rap that we might associate with the West Coast and bringing it to the South. And they're also mumbling. So we kind of get introduced to this idea of mumble rapper. And you have folks rapping about trapping. So trapping, of course, now here, trapping is the actual economy of what is happening in urban Southern spaces, but also in other spaces as well. But they refer to it as trapping, particularly in Atlanta in the early 2000s in the South. They're standing outside the trap house, which becomes this misnomer for a place of community, oftentimes for young Black men who might not have what we call a legal way to business. So they're selling drugs. They're cooking drugs in the trap house. They're selling it out the trap house. They're making music because of the drugs in the trap house. And so it's really about this like raw experience of like, you gave us grimy spaces to exist in sociopolitically in these abandoned urban Southern spaces. And so now we're going to turn them into something that really means something for us. And so that's the trap house.
And what does it sound like?
Really what it sounds like is the beat stuttering, kick drums, the hi-hats. You have a lot of synthesizing that happens in trap music. It sounds deep. I feel like you can feel it when you listen to it.
Now, Claire, you just had us sitting on a wooden pew in
yes.
Albany, Georgia, with Bernice Johnson Reagan. And what in the world does the 808 have to do with this history?
Over my head.
For me, I see it as this continuation of the historical continuity. I guess this is where we could talk about murmurs, right? Where the murmuring comes in. So for me, murmuring really begins in my work with the reading of Du Bois and Souls of Black Folks, where he talks about his trip to Albany. And so in his trip to Albany, he really talks about that he's going to this land where half-intelligible murmurs are coming from the far beyond. And so oftentimes when we think about Du Bois and sound, we go to spirituals or the way that he's calling them sorrow songs. But if we go to this murmur as being a part of a way to how Southern Black folks are using what we might call improper speech to produce what we come to know as in some capacity, a dialect of the Black Southern tongue. So murmuring and mumbling as being a part of speech breaking, as escaping proper language bounds. So if we are to jump, you know, almost 40 years, 30 to 40 years ahead of time, how does that relate? And so for me, I think about the way that Regina Bradley uses the idea that the mountaintop ain't flat. And so we know it's a play for her on King's last speech, where unfortunately until we get to the top of the mountaintop, folks think that racism is done in the South, that there's these new opportunities. And so we have a lot of complicated history that obviously happens after the passing of Dr. King. And still though, we are not having what we might consider this traditional leadership for particularly Black male leadership that we know is a huge part of Black politics. And so she says, like, maybe the rappers decide. They have to talk for their communities now. They have to be the storytellers, right? Like, and in some capacity, they have to be the drum majors for the spaces that they come out of. And so I think that is a like direct lineage of kind of like this kind of like political leadership, and it's taking place of what we know. Because in Black Southern politics, a lot of times there are these huge storytellers across time that are reminding us that shadow, that mumbling of the land and the murmuring is still here and present.
I want to hear you reflect for just a moment on the sonic power that exists.
I think about Black folks who have been told you're not speaking proper English, who have been told that those words aren't real, that what you're saying isn't legitimate sounding, your voice isn't doing it, it isn't matching what we might consider to be like standard ways of speaking. And so I think that desire and that chasing to remain raw is to always be a part of that community. And it's that desire to remain speech breaking. And I think even with King, right, he was really trying to empower folks on the pews more so than the nation sometimes, right? Because he wanted them to remain in love. He wanted them to see the possibilities that could happen. And I think trap music speaks to it, which is why I say it has like liberatory potential. You know, if we're saying that you don't get it, maybe it wasn't meant for you.
Claire Crawford is a doctoral candidate at the University of Southern California, soon to be my colleague at Wake Forest University. Thanks for taking the time with us here on The Takeaway, Claire.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We also want to thank the New York City Municipal Archives, which is the source of the brief portion of a speech from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which we heard a bit earlier.